chappy who taught us all this, the civilian who gave me 3 days CV for saying, I'm no hand nigger, told a few of us when we were chatting to him, and we passed out, and there were no failures in the group, and we were ready to leave, and it took us about, if I remember rightly, about 2 months to do that. And then we were ready for being drafted, and we had a chat with him. And he was a civilian in the listening group from the Home Office, and he was out east. And he told us that he could never understand why the Americans were surprised at Pearl Harbor, because they had not only tracked the Japanese fleet moving into the area, but also DF'd them. And they intercepted messages, and by then the Japanese codes were broken. We knew them. And the information was passed on to their officers, and yet nothing was done. And I see recently on TV an allegation that's been made by someone who's writing a book on it, that the information was never passed to the Americans deliberately as a political move to bring them into the war. The other allegation is that they were being tracked, the Japanese fleet was being tracked by a Dutch submarine. These allegations were made quite openly on television, and they implicate Churchill and the then King. And the book isn't out yet, but it will make interesting reading. And it'll either end up in a major law case, unless it would be quietly brushed under the carpet. Because, you know, I've used the word allegation, I mean, we don't really know. But certainly I know from first hand that this fellow said that they had intercepted the Japanese messages. And I now know that the codes were broken by that time from this book, which I'll refer to later on. So what happened? Well, we were sent overseas. And we went to Mombasa, first of all, which is where the 5th Battle Squadron, which is the fleet out there, the Royal Naval Fleet, had retreated to after the debacle of Singapore, the loss of the Prince of Wales and the repulse. And when we got out there, they were kind of just catching their breath, you know, getting themselves reorganised. The Japanese had bombed Ceylon, hence all the oil in the water, which covered our young lieutenant commander. And it was still in Trinco Harbour all the time I was there when we sailed out of there later on. I don't remember doing any copying, any reading at all at Mombasa, because the naval base there was Kiladini, and there were already plans for moving back. So we spent our time packing up receivers and getting ready for the move. We went over to Ceylon. And we'd been given some practice in listening to the Japanese stations in London, using, of all things, AR-88s. And I could not believe when I heard this Japanese coming out of Sweden, that it's coming all the way from Tokyo. And that, I presume, was when I got hooked on ham radio. And I've never got over it since, quite frankly. And each time I send and each time I receive, the wonderment to me is still there. And we got out there, and we were organised on a listening station, a place called Anderson, just outside Colombo. It was a golf course which they'd taken over and erected a huge antenna farm, rhombic sturdy curtains, the lot. And this whacking great, you know, the RG8U and all the rest of it into the receiving station. And they had about 100 receivers all in bays all around this listening room. And they organised it in naval watches of four on, four off, four on, four off, and then the dog watches from 4 to 6 and 6 to 8, so that you change. Well, the dog watches, I think, are essential in ordinary naval routine, where you're doing that all the time, continuously, four on, four off, four on, four off, and so on. But they considered that the stress of reading this stuff was such that they stood us down every other day. So So what you do, you'd go through 24 hours of this four on, four off, and the dog watches. Then you'd stand down for a day, and you have a complete day off. Which, when our pay was about 1.6 a day or something, if I remember rightly, you couldn't do a lot with your day off, other than make it on entertainment. And this I did, in a variety of ways. But I came home in one piece, but if you go back to Sri Lanka now and you find any 30-odd year old to a coffee, one a cocoa walking around the floor. I deny it all. A typical message, when it was copied, had to be copied in triplicate. For the coders, for the code breakers, the cryptanalysts. And he took it on a message pad, and a typical one looked like that. And I'll describe it to you and then send it to you. This was the call sign of Singapore, which the Japanese called Sionan. And this was Surabaya. The DE was just as we used it, the French from, you know. This is a priority symbol, and just to make it exciting, I've got a top priority. If you got one of those, you know, you hadn't got to miss a single thing. It was a priority rating. This told you how many symbols were coming. A W followed by a 50. Well, we call it a W. Yeah, 50. And then you had to write down the page like they did. And when we first were told this, we thought this is taking things a little bit too far. You know, now do they want us to start over on the right-hand side and work for the left? But they knew what they were doing, these people. Because you'll see in a moment or two why we had to write like that. Now, for those of you who are not familiar with the situation, the only way you could communicate with ships during the war was the ships only sent at their peril. The idea was in ships you kept radio silence all the time, you just listened. We did it. All the combatants did it. And what happens is that a number of shore stations, usually three on a net, we call it a net, operating on the same frequency, would send a message. And here it is, Singapore from Surabaya. And they sent the message. Singapore would pick it up and call somewhere else, perhaps Penang or somewhere, and send the same message. The Japanese operators would take it down. And down here were all the coded addressees. All these are the coded addressees to whom the message is going. And then the text of it invariably was in what we called main fleet cipher. What the Americans called in Calm, the code breakers, they called it purple. And the Americans had broken that code before the war started. So we virtually read everything they were doing. Now, I'll tell you about the book later on if you have time. So this was in their main cipher, or purple as they called it, and it was Arabic numerals, just like ours. And the receivers were all HROs. We found them, what were they, single super hex with a decent crystal in on the 4.655 on air from a bit of phasing. And they were super. We used to listen to sampans, you know, about 5 watts. What frequency we were listening to, I didn't know. They were just numbers on a dial to me then, because I knew nothing about the technical side of radio. The receiver was a box with knobs on. The message, I'll try and point it out as I send it. I have to do it like this. Sorry, I've got the key now. Sorry. The speed they sent at, invariably, now that I don't have to point it out, would be... sent it, and they used bug keys. The Americans had obviously taught them to use big bug keys. They were superb operators. It was good, clean, clear, accurate sending, rarely any mistakes, exceedingly well disciplined. And when they finished it, immediately Singapore, in this case, would pick it up and send it on to someone else, but we didn't have a second chance of reading it, because what we had to do was, when it was coming at us a second time, we were supposed to read it once, and that was enough. We then had, for the cryptanalyst's sake, had to put in the translation, because the cryptanalysts, as in any intelligence, and we all know what intelligence means, it simply means information gathering. It's not the other connotation of intelligence, otherwise I wouldn't have been in it. What we did was to simply transpose, as we say, this lot, and pass it over. Sometimes that would be in plain text, or in five letter groups, in which case you'd be reading all this card to card all the time, which is a little more difficult. But you could take a breather once you got to the numerals, because however fast anyone sends numerals, you can always read them, because there's five digits in every numeral, and you've got so much time to write them down. The TZ at the hour was the equivalent of RAR, da, 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 did it? And so we used to read this stuff and collect it up. It then went a leading hand or a petty officer would come around and just collect your traffic up and take it into the cryptanalyst room. What happened in the cryptanalyst room is in here. I never knew at the time, particularly as I knew I wanted to go to sea and get off the shore base. Anyone with any common sense would know that the less you knew, the better. There's a whole basis of intelligence that it's a case of need to know and nobody else. So I knew nothing at that time about the cryptanalysts, and I found out fairly recently that a fellow who my wife is a friend of his wife's, and this guy was with me in the same place, Jimmy Griffiths from Wallasey. He was telling me fairly recently that he went over to cryptanalysis. He got teased off for reading this stuff. And so he stuck his neck out and went over, but it was never his intention, he said, to get to sea. It was fairly stressing, as I told you. Oh, incidentally, before we move on to that, that exact same traffic read by the Japanese would look like this on their message pad. It's exactly the same thing. But the Japanese katakana symbols are there instead of our English equivalents. And you just read this traffic, you became just like a machine, a robot. And I quickly bored with it, I'm afraid. Some of the fellows found it stressing. We had a very old man with us, actually. He was a classics master from a grammar school in Yorkshire. He was a highly intelligent fellow. He was a theologian, and he taught theology, and he also taught languages. He used to take his Bible in his days off and translate passages into Greek. And he'd take the Greek and translate it into Latin. And he'd take the Latin and translate it into English. and compare the two texts. And a broad Yorkshire accent. And asked him why he did this. He's a very droll character. And they say, oh, I'm just keeping in touch for when I go back. This bloody war won't last forever. But he was an old man. He was at least 40. That's right, I was 19. And one day, this happened a couple of bays up from where I was sitting. The HRO, those of you who know it, remember, had a big dial on it, didn't it, like this? And he used to be listening to his frequency at 2 o'clock in the morning, and it was quiet. And just in case it drifted a bit, he just used to swing around the And the Japanese had to sleep like anybody else, you know, and most of the night, off times, it was quite silent period, he didn't get much at all. And he used to doze off, and the other fellas, this one, he's an old guy, you know, and we just used to plug our phones in, and if his frequency started to open up, we'd just give him a dig, kind of wake up and start reading. As I say, I was a bit further down when this happened, but his name was Boyd, William Boyd, Bill Boyd. The officer watch was a bargee of a fellow who I liked enormously. He's a very rough, gutted guy that suited me. I was a bit that way out myself. And we got on, he and I, quite well. But I think he was a bit jealous of Bill, because Bill was genuinely a highly intelligent man. Bill Pinchon, the old volunteer legatist, thought he was a bit posh. Bill wasn't at all, he was a great guy. And he caught Bill asleep. And we had to keep logs, running logs, of any procedural exchanges. And he slipped his log from under him and did something which was pretty awful. Right across his logbook, he wrote asleep on watch and underlined it and just walked away and left Bill. And when he'd gone out of the room, one of the young fellas gave him a deft dig. And Bill woke up and he rubbed his eyes and looked at it. And I understand it went something like this. Oh, asleep on watch. Oh, and he looked at the signature, W. Pynchon. And he wrote this underneath it. You can see how much Bill Boyd thought of Bill. I thought, now, if my naval history is right, they're going to hang him from the highest yard in Portsmouth Harbour. Or perhaps they let him off and just keelhaul him a couple of times. He was on the lower deck. He was a leading telegraphist at the time, just like me. He could easily have had a commission. And he just disappears off the station, goes away. And he comes out 3 months later as a sub-lieutenant. They promoted him to the upper deck. We didn't see very much of him. He went into cryptanalysis, which he should have been in the first place. Being a fellow of that caliber, that's where he belonged. They started bringing wrens out. It annoyed, or it rankled my male chauvinism to find that there were young girls doing what we were doing, and many of them doing it a damn sight better. For one thing, they had a lot more patience, and they could stick at it where we tended to get bored and cheesed on. And I thought, well, I'm not spending the rest of my war here. I wasn't what we'd call the best of operators. I was only average. I see my naval papers on discharge said satisfactory or something, which now as a teacher I know means it's all right and nothing much wrong. But I got on well with Pynchon. And we went on watch one night and we found the Japanese had split frequencies, so we were only getting one side of the traffic. So he put people on searching for the other side of it, and they found the other frequency. They were working split frequency. And two on the one frequency and one on the other. Pynchon being Pynchon devised an idea where he had two HROs, one like that and one like that, two message pads in triplicate, two log books, sack of pencils, and headphones with one in one ear and one in the other, etc. And they asked me if I'd kind of try this out as an experiment to see if it would work. Well, you and I know that although there were about 8 knobs on an HRO, in reality, what are you tuning? You know, you've got the RF gain, I presume, and you might shift your BFO a bit, but you don't do much else, so it wasn't terribly hazardous. The only thing you have to grab the right message pad and the right logbook. And he said, it doesn't matter if you make a pig's ear out. He said, it's covered anyway. I'm just seeing if it works. And it worked. And he set this up. So they had one operator working split frequencies using 2 HROs. Well, they must have gone further because they then split 3 waves. And they only had... You were listening to one station and the other two were elsewhere. And clearly their operators had 2 receivers, you see, tuned in a different frequency. They only had to hear 2, they didn't have to hear themselves. And we had to try and listen to 3. And I went in one morning and I looked at Bill Fincham and I said, you're buggered now, aren't you? I said, we've only got 2 ears, you know. Like that. Always the rebel. And he goes, a few nights later, so I went in and first watched it, was the 8 till midnight. And he was waiting at the door, rubbing his hands here. And he had a bay set up with plywood all around it and 3 HROs. three logbooks, 3 message pads. He said, one in one ear, one in the other on a speaker. He said, you never beat Fincham. Never. Fincham was never beaten by anybody, not even Bill Boyd when he got his commission. But never beaten. He said, just try it. He said, we've covered on. He said, there's a wren here. She can act as your runner. I said, aye, all right. So I sat down and I was sorting out the lovely message pads and 3 logs. And there was no real one. And we had an ordinary naval message pad there. So I wrote that on it and gave it to the girl and said, we'll take that for the one on the later. It was a little bit rougher than that. I tidied up for the occasion. Well, I've forgotten about this. You know, you do with a little joke like that, that's the end of it. And I kind of got on. And this girl is quite... By this time, about 2 in the morning or something, if I remember right. Yeah. No, it's very late anyway. And this girl reappears after 20 minutes and she taps me on the shoulder and she says, the warranty lady just has sent you this, and it's a brilliant brush. And she said, I don't know what you want to do. And I just said, never mind, dear. You said, never mind. What's he done, this guy? He'd gone and got the bosun's mate out of bed, got the keys out of it, opened the door, got a brush stack, got a brush head, banged them together and brought it in, because Bill always had the last word. Anyway, I got rather bored with it, as I say, and I only stuck it for maybe something on 12 months or something like that, and I found it exceedingly tedious. And the days off dragged. And we hadn't got much money, as I said, so we wondered if there was any way we could get to see. Someone, somewhere, I don't know who, had devised a system of a party going to sea, taking HROs, and sailing in the flagship. Now, any of you have not named, you know anything about it. The flagship could be anything from an aircraft carrier, a battle wagon, a destroyer, a cruiser, even a flipping minesweeper. It's just the ship that the Admiral flies his flag in. And in our case, it was mostly flat tops, but not necessarily. And the idea was we were to phone this guy up if we heard anything which was affecting the operation that we were on. And there were a number of them. And the one that stands out in my memory, because it has a story behind it, was... Sorry. Now, I've drawn a map there. India's down here, Ceylon's over here, this is Burma. You know, and you come down the Malacca Strait here to Singapore and so on. And the idea was that the army were pushing the Japs down here, they were retreating. And they were going to effect a landing on these two islands, Ramri and Chiduba, Marines. And they were going to come ashore and cut off the Japanese retreat before they got down to the Malayan Peninsula. That was the idea of it. And we lay off here. And prior to the landing, we gave a heavy bombardment. Now, one would have thought that they've learned their lesson with the loss of the Prince of Wales and the repulse with no air cover. And the only thing we had was a what we used to call Woolworth carriers. They were little tiny things that the Americans made about one every 6 hours, I think. And they used to catapult off Hellcats. But they, you know, they weren't as effective as they should be. We had nothing big. Because most of the real fleet was out in the Pacific fighting that war where most of the action was. Now, we were there, and I'd organised myself out of a job, which is what all clever people do. You know, they organise everyone else to do things, and then they call themselves the boss, you know, and just supervise it. Now, but you couldn't get away with that. You had to have a receiver and search, you see. They were covering frequencies, covering all this area, so that if they sent out an attacking force of aircraft, we were listening on their aircraft frequencies. Now, we had to be retrained for this by the Air Force, because in the war, the Navy listened to the Navy, the Air Force listened to the Air Force, and the Army listened to the Army. This was it. Bulletin, last but two, refers to the Y Service, if you remember, if any of you read the article. Well, I was in the Naval Y Service. These guys were in the RAF Y Service, and they taught us air procedure. And they used to actually send in the bombers with Morse. You know, they had a key there and they'd send it in Morse. Pretty fast and very clipped. Call signs of one letter and dropped out the DE, you know, and that type of thing. And very fast. And we had to listen to this, and the idea was to identify how many planes were there were and where they'd left and where they were going, particularly if they were coming for you. And we used this, and it was rather nice. We had an officer with us, a fellow from Southport, who actually spoke Japanese. He was a RAF type, and he used to listen on VHF to the fighters in plain language, and he could listen to their chatter. Was it an SX-28 or something? Was it?
SX-27.
He had one of them. And he was sat next to me listening to this, and I was searching, in inverted commas, on this HMO. And meantime, they were knocking hell out of Chiduba and Ramri prior to the landings by laying up and bombarding. And every time the guns went, they set them up and down, and they held them down like this, kept jumping about. But nonetheless, we managed to read. And I said, this is nonsense, I don't even know what frequencies I'm looking at. Now, I can't remember, I think about 8 calls out there in an HRO, something like that, isn't there? I put one of them in, and just went like that on the dial, and then and it stopped. And there was such a hell of a racket in my headphone, blowing my ears off, in Japanese, katakana. But it wasn't Navy, I'd have recognised it, and it wasn't RAF, I'd have recognised, and it didn't take a genius to say, but it must be Army. And it was in plain text. And long time ago, when I first gave these talks, it was still fresh in my mind. And I wrote down one of the words from the plain text message, which was that. And it was nice and slow. It was only coming about 20s. You know, they weren't rushing it. And it was blowing your ears off. And you have to turn the RF gain down. So I copied it in plain text. And next to me was this fellow from the RAF officer, and he said that's plain language. So I said yes. He said, you mean this? I said yeah. He said, I'll let you have it in a minute, because we could, I could transpose it for him straight away, and he could read it. He's not coded it. And if we transpose that, we slow the key down. There it is. Sorry, say again. Okay? That was just one word. And when I transposed it, it said Tongatupu. I can remember that. I remember this funny ending, Tongatupu. And he said, just a minute. Tongu. And it was their way of saying Tongu. And the traffic was from Tongu to Rangoon, asking for a fleet of MTBs to be sent up to investigate units of the British fleet, which were knocking out of them prior to a landing. And I didn't wait for an acknowledgement from the other side. And he said, will you tell the British you lie? So I should have leaned to leg because asking to see the Admiral. Me being a stroppy 20-year-old by then, I said, can I have a go? He said, yeah, go on. So I rang the bridge up and, oh, bridge car. So I said, may I have a word with Admiral Sir James, please? And who is this? Leading to Lady Right. So he said, what? I said, why, sir? Oh, right. They all knew that if I asked to see the Admiral, and I said, the Y service, I have intelligence for them, information. And you always gave it the boss. And I just read him this message, told him what it was, and translation of it and so on. And said, James, he's a remarkably nice fellow. I met him personally on one occasion, and he said, very good, thank you. Just hung up. And with great naval valour, we all took some put it off. Well, really, in any case, the Marines were down and they were in. The opposition was only token. And we were too late anyway because the bullets were going down here. They were near the Rangoon, we were late. Someone was asking me before, why I use an electronic Kia? And I said, because I've never been taught to use a straight one. And to send at the speed I like sending at and reading, I couldn't do it on the straight key. The reason I wasn't taught to use a key, because I had no need of one. There was no way I was going to start talking to the Japanese. But we did have one opportunity. At the end of the war, after Hiroshima and Nagasaki, there was talk among the Japanese that they would fight on in the Malay Peninsula, regardless of what was happening at home. And you remember that long after the war, the Japanese came out of the jungles, 10 and 15 years after the war. This was their fanaticism. And we knew if they did fight on, we'd have to stay out there and get mixed up with it. And we were worried about our prisoners and so on. So units of the British fleet sailed down from Trincomalee over here, down like a straight, and lay off. Singapore's actually an island up here. Lay off here, only a few miles out. And by this time, there's no possible chance of much in the way of retaliation from the Japanese. They had nothing to fight back with, really. Yamamoto had warned them, if you read Khan, the codebreakers, Yamamoto had warned them that they got 12 months in which to secure bases, to get oil, and hope that the Americans would settle for a new coexistent prosperity sphere, as they call it, which of course they didn't. And obviously they were running out of supplies, and although I've been with them when they bombed us and that type of thing, there were no kamikaze attacks on our little lot. That was happening down in the Pacific. And I've been down there once or twice and saw one or two items, but nothing much. But when we sailed down the Malacca Strait, the ship that I was in was an old battle wagon called the Queen Elizabeth. And I was given a message in Japanese. I didn't know what it was. And it was in plain text in Katakana. And I just said, send that. I've sat with a pump handle, you know, that I've never used in my life before. And just sent it, and there's a couple of kilowatt transmitters there, blasting away to Singapore, which is only about 5 or 6 miles away. And I called Singapore CBAR 10-4 from, and the call sign then of our fleet was GZH, and then the number was the unit in the fleet. And Singapore was in QSO with Tokyo and another one, and this was after Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And Singapore wouldn't acknowledge. Well, then Walker, Sir James Somerville, I gather from the Mountbatten talks on television, had been sent home because he and Mountbatten didn't get on very well. And he was replaced by a fellow called Walker, who actually had a hook instead of a hand. He had a brass hook. We used to call him Hooky Walker. And he used to prod people in the back with it. Not the hook, and he was behind me. He said, "Well, have they answered? Have they answered?" I said, "They're having some bother, sir." The ground wave would have fried the bloody. Singapore was lying doggo and wasn't acknowledging, but Tokyo heard it and said to Singapore, "Acknowledge." And Singapore did, just acknowledge the traffic, just the one message. We want this, you know. Because I'm not ego in, we blast them out, you know. Been on the blasting out up here at Penang, and we got blasted out on another occasion. And I was wanting to get home, the war was over virtually, we thought. Anyway, they acknowledged, and the rest is history. And I saw it on television actually not so long ago when you saw them coming out to the ship. They must have photographed it, and because we were down below. And that's the only time I used a straight key. So is he? Gentlemen have asked that, didn't they? So the only time I used a straight key. There's one little funny I'd like to end on. It's been rather a sober lecture this evening. Normally it gets a bit more hilarious than this, but one funny thing that I'd like to tell you about. We came off watch in the middle of all this when I was still on the shore base, and we had a new officer who'd been sent out who was going to spark up all these white operators who had a day off every other day, and the rest of the Navy didn't operate like that, and why should they have a day off, and so on. We were coming off watch one morning at 8 o'clock, and from 4 till 8 is not the nicest time to be on watch. And we were looking forward to a day off. It's breakfast, bed, get up in the afternoon and do what you wanted to do. And we were met by a new Chief Petty Officer Telegraphist who said, "D-Watch," that was the watch I was in, "D-Watch will muster at the signal school at 08:45 for further training." Heard of this, you know. Who the hell does he think it is, you know? So, anyway, we went down there. And we had with us a homosexual. And he was one of the nicer types of homosexuals. Some of them, to me, are quite sickly, but he wasn't. He used to advertise that he was homosexual if he was looking for a mate by mincing and so on. But if he was with people that he knew were not that way inclined, he dropped this. So his name was Peter. And I used to call him Pete to make him sound a bit more masculine. But he was a smashing bloke, a delightful person. And Peter was in our watch. And he was walking in, and no mincing or anything. He said, "This is..." He said, "What the hell's he on about? Do you know?" He said, "What's he trying to do?" I said, "I don't know." No, he sat on one side of the signal school classroom, and I sat in there. There'd be about 30 of us. And we were all showing that we were tired, you know, like this. And this chief says, "Now then," he says, "we're going to go on to some, they didn't call it phone, RT, we're going on to some RT procedure. I want to check that you still know your RT." We weren't going to use any RT procedure anywhere, but this was his way of saying, "You'll tell the bloody lie like the rest of us, you see." And we couldn't say no, it was a discipline for. So we just showed our resentment, and I was going looking at him like this and going off asleep. And he said, "I suppose you know it all, do you?" I said, "Yes, Chief, I know it all." just like that. Oh, you know it all, do you? Pick anyone in the room, allocate him a call sign, and send him a message in the correct naval procedure. I said, yes, all right, Chief. And there was Pete on the other side, playing Pete with his pocket. I said, all right, Pete. And as soon as I said that, the lads knew something was on. And God bless him, he came back in his best mint in town and said, yes, all right, Norman, he said. I said, your call letters, Peter, are JJ. I said, and mine are UG. He said, all right, Norman. Now, the phone procedure that you use now, which is not based on NATO, has changed and changed again. In those days, the letter J was Jig. And if you allocated JJ, that had a certain context. So I said, hello, Jig G. Hello, Jig G. This is Uncle George. This is Uncle George. This is Uncle George. Report my signals. Report my signals. Over. And he came up. Hello, Uncle George. Hello, Uncle George. This is Jig Jig. This is Jig Jig. You're loud and clear. You're loud and clear. Over. Well, better this time the fellows are down. I'm reminded of people. So this trotted back and you have to go through a hell of a rigmarole, you know, before you could even start. You had to say, I have a message for you, you know. And then he had to say, send your message. And it was going on, and eventually I was waiting for the last bit. And he said, send your message, over. So I said, hello, Jig Jig, hello, Jig Jig. This is Uncle George, this is Uncle George. Your ship is turning, over. He jumps up. And they all walked out, and he watched me right out the room. And as I walked past him, he said, one bloody smile about you. I know, Chief. Well, there are lots of little anecdotes that we kind of changed them. Someone told me recently when I gave this to Warrington and then repeated it over at Winsford, the two lads, twins from Warrington who set it up, said, different.
It's different
every time.
Hey, I hope you've enjoyed it.
Have any questions for Norman, gentlemen?
Questions at all?
You mentioned something, Norman, about some connection between carbon-carbon and computers. Would you like to go into that?
Yeah, it is simply that the younger of both of my sons are in computers. One right at the top in it, and this other guy is primarily a salesman, programmer, and God knows what. And he's particularly concerned is with printout. And he was showing me a device that he's been developing in his firm where they change the golf ball on the printout for different languages. And he said, and these are the languages that on the golf ball, you say, this is for, you know, cutting it out when it comes in on the printout. And there's a whole list of Japanese symbols. And I said, what are they? And he said, katakana. Now, he doesn't know anything about this lecture. You know, I've never discussed any of this with my boys. They don't want to hear Dad's wartime experiences. And I said, can I have it? So I borrowed it. And I actually asked him if he could have got me a blown-up version of to bring tonight. Just to, so obviously, what they're doing, it would appear, and it's only conjecture on my part, that they are communicating with the West by this system.
Yes, I've seen.
Mm-hmm. It's just guesswork on my part. I don't see.
Transcoding
the
language in a way.
Yes, well, what they're doing, they're, when I showed you some of those words like Yamamoto and Hiroshima and Nagasaki and so on, and this firm in Fukuyama, what they do, obviously, they just, I suppose, I mean, when we see it in English on there, that's the way the Japanese would say the same word, wouldn't they? Yes. So they put the symbols up in katakana.
And anyone who can read the Carta Carmen, it's fairly easy to learn, yeah. You know, fairly easy to learn. How long are you going to take it to master that? Not very long. Yeah. And you can communicate.
Any more questions, Jack? Well, it's always nice to see you, Norman. And especially when you give a lecture like that one. It's very, very good indeed. I mean, it's been some time, I think, since you gave that lecture to this club. But we've got a lot of new members, and it's the first time they've ever heard it, I think. And it's very, very good indeed. Your appreciation, Ben. Thank you.
For inviting me. It's always a pleasure to come to the Chester Club for whatever reason, and I said to Peter when I came in, I wonder when the World Amateur Radio Society will be like this, because believe you me, it isn't at the moment. Thank you very much indeed.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Very good. I've heard it gets better at the time. Thank you very much again.